behind will truly mark this earth. But treachery and love are ours to keep for all their worth.
Our next guest here on the program is a singer, songwriter, producer. He has recorded over a dozen studio albums, is a three-time Grammy Award winner for his work as well, and we are so thrilled to be joined this afternoon by Joe Henry. Joe, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, Rich, it's my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
And I have to ask the status. Are you now officially a Mainer?
I am indeed. I'm in a rental house at present. My wife and I, we are building a house in Harpswell, but we are camped in Bath while the work progresses, and we've let go of everything else. So here we are.
Well, that's a wonderful spot down there. What drew you to Maine?
Well, you know, we've been in Los Angeles for over 30 years, you know, thinking we would only be there for two or three, like a lot of people, and then things just take their own course. But we really missed a true Four Seasons. My wife is a native of Michigan, and I came of age there. And, you know, Los Angeles has a lot to offer, but it's not poet's weather there. You know, when it's 90 degrees on Halloween, and I've experienced that many times, you know, the poets weep. And we really miss, you know, true winter and a more peaceful day-to-day life, closer to natural beauty. Maybe I'm giving away my age, but I think I thought that decades ago as well, but my work had kept me pretty welded to Los Angeles.
Well, we're awfully glad to have you here in the state of Maine. I told you in our email conversation that our friend Van Dyke Park said, "Man, you got to talk to my friend Joe Henry. We love Van Dyke," who was on with us yesterday. How did you two get together?
Well, we've known each other for a really, really long time. He actually did some orchestration for one of my earliest records, though I didn't really get to know him at that point. I was barely in the room with him. But once I was in Los Angeles, I was invited one afternoon to be a part of a small group of musicians sitting on the stage at the Will Gear Theater out in Topanga, talking about songs and singing a few of them. And I was with T-Bone Burnett and Sam Phillips and Jackson Browne, and Van Dyke was there to sort of moderate the afternoon, and we fell into such deep conversation, and we just kind of never let up. You know, he's one of my dear, dear friends and one of my favorite people to have a martini with, that's for sure.
I saw a quote of yours that really caught me. You said, "Whenever true emotional understanding was available to me, songs were its delivery system."
True enough. Even before I understood that that's what was happening to me, I can look back and know that songs were the way that I kept things grounded, and even more significantly, kept my mind up in the ether. You know, I think all of us try to live in that kind of balance where we do feel grounded, but we don't feel trapped by day-to-day mundane existence. And songs were always there, keeping me rooted and inviting me out beyond what I could readily imagine.
Hey, you've also talked about the influence of great writers, one, of course, being Garcia Marquez. How did they influence you, and how do you take what they did and translate it into your own art?
Well, Rich, I sometimes think it's too on the nose only to talk about songwriting in terms of other songwriters. Though, you know, I've studied, you know, all the great songwriters as deeply as I've been able to. But I sometimes feel that that doesn't allow new perspective as you're really starting to find your footing. And I think I was about 21 or 22 when I read 100 Years of Solitude. And it said more to me in that moment about what I thought good writing, even good songwriting, might be than anything else I could name. You know, it was hallucinatory. It was deeply, you know, erotic. It was it was free. It was untethered by the, you know, notions of what we think are possible in our waking lives. And I knew as I was reading it very consciously that that's what I wanted my songs to do if I was able to keep writing them, as I wanted them to be untethered as I heard his writing voice to be. And at the same time, I was deeply invested and remain so in short story writers, you know, from Alice Munro to Eudora Welty, Flannery O'Connor, Mae Carver. You know, it's all storytelling. And sometimes when we're just keeping our noses deep into other songwriters, you know, it's sort of like being chin deep in the middle of a great lake. You can't really sense where you are exactly. But reaching into work by artists in other mediums, you know, writers like I mentioned, or filmmakers, photographers, you know, it all just sort of opens up the possibilities of how we tell stories to each other. And to do things so specifically can sometimes limit our emotional responsivity to them. But when we learn how to get a little bit untethered, as I said before, things expand and things become more easily adaptable for people to come and go as listeners.
We're talking with Joe Henry on Downtown. Did I read that the first 45 you ever bought was Glen Campbell's Galveston?
That's absolutely true.
Well, I love that story because we're about the same vintage, and I think the first album that I scraped together $1.99 for, or whatever it was back in the day, was the Wichita Lineman album.
Well, and still incredibly evocative and moving music. You know, I don't really have any embarrassing records in my collection. I've sometimes been asked, "Oh, what's your guilty, you know, pleasure, you know, what did you really love that you were embarrassed about?" I said, not a damn thing, you know. I bought Galveston when I was, I don't know, 7 years old, and then very quickly thereafter, Wichita Lineman, Dusty Springfield's Son of a Preacher, and then the first LP I ever bought with my own money was Johnny Cash Live at San Quentin.
That's a pretty good start right there. Jimmy Webb is a great friend of our show. He's been on a number of times, and I don't know. There's great music out there, but you'd be hard-pressed to find a better line than "I need you more than want you, and I want you for all time."
Oh, Rich, that's for the ages, you know. You know, I can throw my mind back and almost remember, you know, even as a naive, you know, seven-year-old, you know, shuddering at the truth that I knew was being spoken. You know, that's incredibly deep record making from, you know, the peerless songwriting and, you know, terrifically great production that was both earthy and country in its orientation, but by no means was that all that was going on. You know, it was kind of operatic in scope and just opened my mind. You know, when you're quite young, you're vulnerable to being influenced because you don't know that's what's happening to you. You don't have any guardrails up. You know, I don't think I had one thought that I could decide that something, you know, was good or not good. I just drank it all up, and you know, I'm really grateful that was my point of entry. I was a child in the South and was hearing a lot of country music and Southern soul music. And, you know, I know that really did set my foundation.
You mentioned T-Bone Burnett. He was such a great mentor to you and opened up new doors for you. What's the key to being a good producer?
Well, not everybody works the way that I work or the way that I've witnessed T-Bone working. You know, what I learned from him, and it sort of just affirmed something I instinctively already believed, is that, you know, you don't really tell people what to play. You know, what it means to be a good producer is to be a really devoted listener and letting everybody in the room who's contributing know that they're being heard. And I had a friend ask me, he said, you know, singers sing for you in a different way than they sing for other producers. He said, you know, he listed a number of singers, Bonnie Raitt, I can't remember who all he named in that moment. He said, you know, what's your secret? And I just said, I always sit in the room where the singer can see me, and they always know that I'm listening. I haven't stepped out of the room to take a call. I'm not doing email. I'm completely, at attention to what they're offering. And when people know that they're being heard and respected, you know, they'll open a vein for you. You know, they'll give you everything. You can't stop them from doing it.
You produced Don't Give Up on Me for Solomon Burke. We had music journalist Peter Grounlich on a few weeks ago talking about his new book, and he said Solomon Burke was the greatest singer he ever saw in person. What was that experience like?
Well, you know, I felt like, I felt like I was an amateur lion tamer climbing in a cage with a lion. You know, he was so, you know, his artistry was enormous. His history was enormous. And keep in mind, I had not produced very many records other than my own at that moment. I was an outlier. I was not the most employable person who wanted that job, I can assure you. But, you know, we got on really well. And, you know, I think he knew that I was trying to help him do something he hadn't done before. I wasn't trying to put a new set of clothes on him. I was not trying to dress him up to be something other than he was. But I also didn't want him to be trapped by his history. We were not trying to recreate, you know, any of his early records. I was trying to find a way to just really focus a light on where he was in that moment. And it's a very folksy record, and I think it confused him a little bit in the beginning, but I think he came to know that you know, I wasn't just trying to have an idea with no regard to who he really was in his true heart. I just wanted to clear away all clutter so that everybody could hear, you know, not only how great he had been, but how great he still was.
We were talking about you with Loudon Wainwright III not too long ago, because I told him I love the music that you guys did together on Strange Weirdos, Daughter, Grand LA, and then what is one of my all-time favorite songs, both Loudon's version and your version, You Can't Fail Me Now.
Well, I love Loudon. I mean, he is family to me and my family. And, you know, he was a hero of mine since I was about 15. So it was no small thing for me to meet him, you know, and begin working with him at a point, because my admiration is so great, and I think he is, you know, savagely underrated. So, you know, people who understand, you know, who he is really know that he's completely singular. But I think he is a truly, you know, American original. And he's also grown to be one of the most emotionally effective singers of his generation. I truly believe it.
How did you manage to get Ornette Coleman to play on Richard Pryor Addresses a Tearful Nation?
Well, I wrote him a very nice letter. I didn't really think that would do it. You know, I was, you know, fully prepared, you know, to hear back that he was not interested. And at first I did hear that, you know, someone from his camp responded to me very kindly and just told me that, you know, Ornette's been asked by everybody in the world to play on their music. And he felt like to say yes to some people and no to others was like judging the work. And he didn't want to do that. So I was told, you know, he wishes you well. He's going to go back doing what he does, and you should carry on doing what you're doing, which is kind of what I expected. And then a couple of days later, I get a call from the same woman, and she said, I'm really shocked to be calling you back, but Ornette spent the weekend listening to your last record, which I had sent along with my letter. And he understands exactly why you want to work with him, and he wants me to tell you that he'd be delighted. And, you know, I really couldn't believe it, you know, even though I had, you know, a little bit of a vision about it as I was writing the song. I just thought, well, if I'm going to speak as Richard, I need somebody of equal significance to sort of be a musical representation for him on this track somewhere. And Ornette was the first person that came to mind, and I had a way to reliably get a letter to him. So I thought, you know, he will say no, but I'm going to ask anyway, because I've always had really, really good fortune in my working life, you know, by writing a nice letter.
We're talking with Joe Henry on Downtown. Can you share the story about the time Harry Belafonte gave you a bit of a hard time about steering clear of politics in your music?
Well, we were traveling together. I was working with him on some music for the documentary he was making of his life. And we were sitting up very late in the hotel bar in Berlin one night, just a group of us who were traveling together. And I was having what I thought was a very private conversation with his daughter, Gina, at the other end of the table, while Harry was holding forth at the other end of this very long table. And somehow, in the midst of his conversation, he overheard me say to her that I had never allowed a point of view of my personal politics to enter into the songs that I was writing. And he stopped all conversation and really raked me out. He said, you know, I'm not a writer. I wish I was, but I'm not a songwriter, but you are. And I don't think you're allowed to opt out. It's the stakes are too high, and we're too deep into the game of our lives here for you to decide that you just don't want to have a point of view. You're not willing to go on record. And he said, and you know why? I think that you think it doesn't look cool on you. You know, I think you want to be aloof, and I'm going to suggest to you that you need to get down here in the dirt with the rest of us. And I was terribly embarrassed. But more to the point, I knew in that moment that he was absolutely right, that I didn't think it looked good on me to be to let politics enter into the work that I was trying to do. And I went back to my room, it was 2 or 3 in the morning, whatever it was, and I you know, I really did some soul-searching about why I would adopt such a point of view when I've been very moved by other artists who are very vocal about their political affiliations and standing up on behalf of truth and justice, because I believe that in my life, but I had never really considered why I was protecting my work from that part of my person. And it changed me. I did begin to operate very differently after that.
You teamed up with Billy Bragg for a wonderful project, the recording, A Shine of Light, field recordings from the Great American Railroad. How did you come up with that idea? And what was that experience like of traveling the country and singing those songs?
Oh, it was wonderful. I mean, Bill and I had been friends for a really long time. And of course, you know, this was his idea. I think it would have absolutely, an idea like that would have had to come from a foreigner, because he had an aerial view of who we were, as who we are as a country. And he said, when he called me on a Sunday afternoon from England and pitched the idea, that he said, you know, most Americans that I know talk about the railroad as if it's nostalgia, as if it's the past. And you don't understand how much your country still relies on railroad. You know, you put more freight on the rails than any industrialized nation in the world, and yet you think that it lives in antiquity. And so he had this idea of wanting to reclaim, as present tense language, you know, the tradition of railroad in an American songbook. So, you know, it was a complete gaffe. You know, he came to Los Angeles, and we ran through songs at my house for a couple of days that included Chicago, and took the longest route that's still in existence in the continental United States, starting in Chicago south to San Antonio and then turning west for Los Angeles. And we stopped, you know, at any time the train stopped for more than literally 4 minutes, we jumped out on the platform with our recording engineer, Ryan Freeland, and, you know, knocked out one or two takes of whatever song we had been just rehearsing in the sleeper car. And, you know, did that over the 64-hour trip, got into Los Angeles at 5 in the morning, it was still pitch black, and found a quiet outdoor spot at the Union Station in Los Angeles and recorded the very last song, you know, and then went back to my house and sort of fell over. But it was a really, really meaningful trip because he's my dear brother. And, you know, we were sharing a sleeper compartment. I was in the upper bunk and he in the lower. You know, I felt like we were two guys in the army. But it was, it was very profound for me to be doing something that immediate. You know, I make records really quickly, you know, typically 3 to 5 days of recording for almost everything I do, both as an artist and a producer. But even more so, jumping out onto a train platform, keeping one eye out on the porter who's going to make sure that we know to get ourselves back on the train before we get left behind, and blowing through one or two takes of something with people pushing past us, you know, it felt so immediate. And it was also fascinating to understand that for most people, you know, nobody gave us a look. You know, seeing a couple blokes with guitars on a train platform, as it turns out, you know, is no big thing. People were intrigued by it. Our recording engineer and his setup. He had a very quick portable rig that he had invented, sort of like opening an umbrella, and there were four microphones on the same shaft so that we could stand face to face and sing together. People thought that was fascinating, but nobody really paid Billy or I any attention whatsoever, which was perfectly great.
Well, it's wonderful music. Now, your most recent album, The Gospel According to Water, well documented that you were writing that during an incredibly stressful time in your life, dealing with serious illness. And we played a little bit of Bloom coming into our conversation here this afternoon. And on the one hand, obviously, you know, that's about what was going on. But I feel like there's a bigger story there when you write about the need to carry on from here. Was that an acknowledgement of the need to carry on, or was it encouragement?
Well, I suppose it was both, but interestingly, that is one of the only two songs on the record that I wrote before I had been diagnosed with cancer. I knew I didn't feel great, but I didn't understand what was happening to me. I was in the west coast of Ireland doing a writing residency at a small art college in the seaside town of Ballyvaughan. And that's one of the songs I wrote. And then almost immediately after coming home, I found out what was happening with me and to me, and then went deep into a writing mode because that was what I did for my sanity and my spiritual survival. But it was interesting to me to go back and listen to the couple of songs I had written before I actually understood what the landscape was for me, and realize that they were all sharing the same language. You know, I think my body knew before my mind did, you know, what was afoot. But in truth, it, you know, when I felt really coward, you know, when we're living in fear of anything, the first thing that escapes us is our creative problem solving. And I was paralyzed, but I realized very soon that when I got up very early in the morning and I was getting up in pitch darkness, no matter how frightened I was, and I certainly was, if I could begin a song, if I could start writing anything, then the doors and windows sort of opened for me. I wasn't as limited. You know, my imagination was not closed down. So once again, you know, there was music sort of opening a door for me and elevating me in a way that I didn't know how to do for myself.
I love the song from the album, Orson Welles. I'm a huge Welles fan, and I was watching just the other night, Citizen Kane was on, and I watched it for, I don't know, the 30th or 40th time in my life. And that line, is that what inspired you? The line when he says to a reporter on the phone, Charles Foster Kane says, "You provide the prose poems, I'll supply the war."
Well, when I first began writing the song, and the title came first, I was on a very quick plane ride from Los Angeles to San Francisco with my wife. We were going to go see a friend in a play. And I just got my notebook out. It's only a 50-minute slide or something. And I pulled my notebook out because I'm trained to do it, and I just found myself, for no apparent reason, writing Orson Welles at the top of the page. I knew it was a good title for something, but I didn't know what it had to say to me. I didn't know what Orson was going to be the delivery system for. So I just started writing like I always do, keeping myself away from, you know, any thought of what I'm trying to accomplish. But when I got, you know, to what I understood the chorus might be, that line, a mutation of that line from the film just sort of offered itself up and retroactively made sense of my title. But it was really not a preconceived idea. It never is. I really don't sit there and think, oh, this is a great metaphor for this, and I'll shore it up with this line that will tie this all together. It just doesn't happen for me that way. But, I know that the song is not about Orson, but I know that he allowed me to speak as I needed to in that moment, and I'm grateful to him. And by the way, Rich, I also, just a couple of weeks ago, rewatched Citizen Kane myself for the, I don't know, 25th, 30th time, who knows what it was. And I was just as enthralled as I've ever been by it.
Absolutely. But so how's your health today, Joe?
I'm doing very well, thanks. And I'm you know, well enough to have you know, made a move across the country and left my UCLA doctor. And it occurred to me when I arrived in Maine that I must believe I have a future. Otherwise, I don't think I would have the nerve, you know, to walk away from that relationship and be doing something as ambitious as we are doing here in your beautiful state.
Well, we're so happy to have you here, Joe, and it's great to have the opportunity to speak with you this afternoon. Thank you so much for spending a little time with us today.
Rich, it's my pleasure. I really appreciate the invitation, and it's great to be here. We have been made to feel very welcome.
Well, you are indeed welcome, and hopefully we can talk again sometime, Joe.
That'd be great. I appreciate it, Rich. Thank you.
It's Joe Henry with us here on Downtown.